Hello and welcome to Untangled Resolutions, broadcast of The Problem is the Answer, a weekly radio show about communication and relationships. I am your host, Batavita Mtumbani, relationship coach and divorce mediator, coming to you live from Harlem, USA. You are listening to the lovely voice of Somi, a rising star who hails from East Africa. Next week, she's recording a new live album, and if you are in the New York City area, you can be part of the audience. More about that later. Today's topic is it murder if she asks for it? I've invited D.A. Graham, the Princeton University Ombudsman, to join me in a conversation about empathy and compassion in our communities, and whether there is ever any justification for harming another person. I'm sure that you have a lot to say about that, so call in or join in the chat room and let your voice be heard. We'll get started in just a moment.
Mermaids while singing, arrive upon your own. You've conquered the darkness, now eat the sand and stone.
Well, hello, everyone. This is Batavita Mtumbani coming to you from Harlem, USA. And what you've just experienced is one of the little technical difficulties you can have on a show like this. One of the nightmares for a broadcaster is dead air. And you didn't hear me freaking out, but I was. I couldn't get my mic to turn on. But I'm here now, and I'm glad that this did work out and everything is good to go. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Somi. And the song that you heard her singing is called Rising, from her 2009 release, If the Rains Come First. I'll be telling you more about how you can become part of the studio audience for Somi's first live album a bit later in the show. She will be recording not this week, but next week at the Jazz Standard. And so I'll give you information about how you can go and hear her live and be part of the studio audience. Today, we're going to dive right into our topic and get started with our conversation. Is it murder if she asked for it? Today's topic was inspired by a story I heard a couple of weeks ago. M.G. Hardy, who is a listener to the show and a friend on Facebook, and he's a bit of a provocateur and an author, although he's a provocateur in a good way, and he's a great author. He posted a story on Facebook about a husband and wife who had a fight of some kind around 12:30 in the morning out in California. And apparently what happened is that the husband and wife had a fight. He left the house and got in the car. She didn't want him to leave. So she went and stood in front of the car. She got in front of the car, and then somehow, according to the newspaper report that I've looked at, somehow she ended up on the hood. So we can kind of imagine how that might have happened, how she ended up on the hood, but somehow she ended up on the hood of the car. And he took off in the car driving. And he didn't just drive out the driveway and maybe down the road a little bit. He actually drove, he got on the highway and drove for 35 miles with his wife clinging to a windshield wiper in the side mirror, according to the report. She was clinging to the car, on the hood of the car, and he was driving at speeds of up to 100 miles an hour. And that's according to witnesses who saw her on the car with him driving and decided to follow and try to keep up with him. And so that's how they were able to report how fast he was going. So he drove for 35 miles and eventually slowed down enough that she was able to roll off the car, and he took off again. Then a Good Samaritan picked her up, took her to the hospital. She had to be treated for hypothermia and the cuts and scrapes and bruises that she sustained when she rolled off the car. The police later found the husband and have now charged him. The district attorney has charged him with attempted murder and kidnapping, among other charges. So the story is incredible in and of itself. And I was, of course, blown away, as many people have been, in hearing the story. But I was equally concerned by the reactions that I witnessed in the last couple of weeks as I've talked this issue over with a number of people. On the Facebook page, we had a conversation that went on for quite a while. And the question that really set me back, somebody asked, is it murder if she asked for it? Is it murder if she asked for it? And I had to sit back and think, wow, what does it mean to ask that question? And the person who asked that question wasn't the only person that I encountered who said, well, you know, she got on the car. And so that had me thinking about how we think about victims of crimes and who is a victim and how much responsibility do we place on a victim for what happens to them when they are harmed by someone else, and about the expectations we have for our own behavior in a community as we live with each other. What about empathy and compassion and civility? So I had questions about that. You know, one of the things that happened in the conversation on Facebook is that people were confused about why would he be charged with attempted murder and with kidnapping? Because from their standpoint, they were thinking, well, he wasn't trying to kill her. You know, he was just trying to drive off, and she just happened to be on the car. So he's trying to drive off, and she just happened to be on the car. So I went ahead and I looked it up. You know, I have a law background. I don't practice law, but I do have a law degree. And so this is an area that's interesting to me. And I thought it might be useful for you to understand as we talk about the case and we talk about the issues surrounding the case, about community responses to the case, that you have a little bit of an understanding about why he might be charged with attempted murder, why he is charged with attempted murder. And so I looked up the definition of attempted murder, the legal definition of attempted murder in California. And there's a website called www.shouselaw.com that I got this information from, and I have put that link up in the chat room, and I'm hoping that the chairman of the chat room can copy down the links that are in the chat room so that they can be put up when necessary. But according to this website, attempted murder is when you take at least one direct but ineffective step toward killing another person or fetus, and that you intended to kill that person or fetus. Okay, so you have to take a step and you have an intent to kill. Now, in this situation, people were like, well, you know, he's driving down the road. He had a fight with his wife. He's, you know, driving down the car. It's not as though he set out looking to kill her. And there are situations that are so dangerous that if you put a person into that kind of a situation, the law will assume that you intended the natural consequences, the potential natural consequences of your actions. So in this situation, driving down the highway at rates of speed up to 100 miles an hour with a person clinging to the hood, the law is going to make you responsible for that. And they're going to say, you know that chances were very likely that this woman was not going to be able to hang on. In fact, I mean, the fact that she did, for 35 miles, she was able to hang on to that car is just amazing in and of itself. But, you know, the chances of her being dislodged from the car and being killed, and even killing other people, but the chances of her being killed were so great that the law will assume that you intended for her to be killed. Of course, there are defenses and there are self-defense laws and or you know, the statute allows for self-defense. If you use reasonable force to defend yourself or another person that you reasonably believe that is going to harm you or another person, you know, that you're about to suffer imminent bodily harm, you are allowed to counter with deadly force if deadly force is used against you. And so you can read more about that on the website. In this situation, again, it doesn't look like she was intending to kill him, that there was reason for him to be in fear of his life for her. Of course, we don't know what happened in the house. What we do know is about what happened with her driving down the highway on the hood of the car. And at that point, it didn't seem that his life was in imminent danger. And so for that reason, the DA, I think, is choosing to charge him with attempted murder. The kidnapping charge is also interesting. And in this situation, it seems kind of novel. How is it that she was kidnapped? Well, she wasn't able to escape. She was being moved from one place to another against her will. And that is the classic definition of kidnapping, that you take somebody against their will and you move them from one place to another for a substantial distance. And 35 miles, I think, is considered pretty substantial. So there you have it, what the law says about what he did in terms of kidnapping and murder, what the legal definitions are. So with that in mind, we can get into talking about the reactions of the community. And I have asked my good friend and colleague, D.A. Graham, who is the Princeton University Ombudsman, to join me today to talk about this issue. And I'm going to bring him on the line. I see I have a caller waiting, and I'm going to ask you to wait for just a little bit longer while we go through the introductions with D.A. and hear a little bit about his background. And then we'll be able to bring other folks into the conversation, and we're eager to do that. But let me get D.A. on the air first. Hey, D.A., how are you doing?
Hey, Betavale, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. It's so good to have you here on the show.
Hey, it's great to be a guest, and just want to let you know I've enjoyed your previous shows as well.
Oh, fantastic. That's really good to hear and very encouraging. Yep. Encouragement is always welcome. You know, the first thing I'd like to get into, and I'm sure that a lot of people are asking this question, is what is an ombudsman? You know, in my prior life, I was an ombudsman, and people would ask, so what do you do? And I said, I'm an ombudsman. And they said, ombuds what? So talk just a bit about that. What is that?
Well, you know, so I'm what you call, or you and I were what you called organizational ombudsman. We are designated neutrals or impartials in dispute resolution. We are dispute resolution practitioners. So our major function is to provide independent, impartial, confidential, and informal assistance to managers, if you work at a corporation, employees, clients, and people we like to call visitors in the ombuds field. And so we have other stakeholders of either the corporation or university or non-governmental agencies, or even now you're finding a lot of governmental agencies having ombudsman.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, as an independent and neutral employee of the institution, you know, I have the opportunity and other ombuds ideally have no other roles. I notice I said ideally. other roles or duties in the organization. So in order to, what's really important to the office, I think, are the neutrality, the fact that you have no skin in the game, and the significant piece is the confidentiality also, where what is said to you or when people are coming to talk to you, they're not speaking to the institution. They're just talking to you.
And what kind
so
of
I really enjoy that.
Okay, I'm so sorry. I keep talking over you. Okay, I'm going to sit back and let you do your thing.
No, it's fine.
Because every time you say something, I'm like, oh, wait, I want to ask a question about that. So what kinds of things what kinds of things do people bring into the office?
Well, so, you know, I work at Princeton University, so you have I have, you know, visitors who are faculty, staff, and students. And so it is a plethora of issues. You have, you know, employee-to-employee conflict or employee-to-manager conflict. You have people who are not happy with the way that they're being treated by their manager or that they've been given an evaluation that they think is unfair or that they are being managed out of the organization unfairly. Students are not happy with either grades or they're having roommate conflict or policies that the university is putting out that they are having some issues with that as well. And so it could be tenure issues, you know, tenure with faculty. There are tenure issues, or even issues with fellow colleagues in departments. I'll never forget the time where I had two faculty members, you know, actually standing up about to go to blows in a faculty meeting. So,
wow.
You actually, you know, civility is one of the biggest things that we try to push for. One of the things that we use is what we call alternative dispute resolution, which you know all too well. And we try to have a sensibility about the organization, the people of that organization, and try to help, try to do some creative problem solving.
So
that's very important.
All right. And, you know, that leads me into why I called on you particularly to talk with me about and talk with all of us who are listening to the show about the topic for today. You know, talking about civility and empathy and compassion and a sense of community togetherness. So a little later in the show, I'd like to get into your background and specifically how you became an ombudsperson. But in terms of today's topic, when you first heard about the story, what were your thoughts?
You know, I was not surprised. That was it was not a shock to me. I think, and I have to ask myself, you know, are we becoming desensitized to domestic violence, violence upon one another, that is so commonplace nowadays? You just look at it and say, oh, you know, that's sad, and thank goodness she wasn't harmed physically to that. But I was, you know, I was shocked that she held on for so long. That really wasn't taken that that really caught my attention, that and the temperature of that night also caught my attention. It was below freezing that night as well, and so yeah, it's a very compelling story, and I love the way you couch the question there.
Right. Well, and that is. You know, what struck me is the fact that she was able to hang on and that she, in spite of the temperatures and everything, but again, you know, the question having to do with, you know, are we becoming desensitized? What is going on with us as a community? When you work, when you do your work, are you finding a change in, over the years? Have you found a change in how people think about violence and justify or not justify violence?
I'm finding that people are more willing to think about it than in years past. I'm finding that people want to, they literally talk out loud about wanting to hurt someone who has either what they feel bullied them or, you know, wronged them in some way. One of the issues that we unfortunately deal with at universities is sexual assault. And I'm talking male and female.
Right.
And so the survivors, for the most part nowadays, I'm hearing more, you know, that they want to find a way to retaliate than in years past, where they wanted to, you know, more, it was more of a psychological trauma that they were experiencing. Not to say that that doesn't happen today either, but there seems to be this more willingness to do something physically about it. So I'm finding that to be quite alarming as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. But listen, we've got, and I find it equally alarming, of course, we have a caller who has been waiting very patiently. I'm going to go ahead and bring the caller in. This is from the 646 area code, and I am eager to hear what you have to say about this topic. Caller, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Alicia. And
Alicia, hi.
I think I accidentally... I'm sorry, but I've just been listening. I think I followed the wrong instructions, so I didn't mean to...
Oh, did you press one?
Barely. I did. I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do. Sorry about that, everyone. So,
Not at all.
Just right now just listening. But okay. I did come in a little late and apologize for that. But I'm trying to understand exactly what the focus of this particular discussion is at this point.
Right. So for others who might be joining the show now, what we're talking about is my concern about a reaction that I witnessed to a story about a woman who was basically driven by her husband. She was hanging on to the hood of the car, and he drove off with her hanging onto the hood and drove 35 miles at speeds of up to 100 miles an hour. And he's now being charged with attempted murder and with kidnapping. And the reactions that we got from, that I heard from some folks were sort of like, well, why? Why would he be charged with that? She asked for it. And so that's why the title of the show is it murder if she asked for it? That's actually a question that somebody asked. So that's what the show is about. Do you want me to go ahead and put you back on mute, or would you like to comment?
I'd like to listen a little bit more, but when I did read, you know, the headline for the show, my first thought was, well, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know if she was asking for it as much as I think that she has to take some responsibility as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, anger makes, and passion in general makes people do irrational things sometimes, and it's as irrational to drive 35 miles at speeds up to 110 miles per hour with someone on your hood as it is for someone to jump on the hood to begin with. So that's why I'm kind of like, they're both responsible, and if there is a law that, you know, if there's a charge that could be put against her for putting herself and him in that position, then I think that it needs to be enforced. Because that was not a very smart move on her part. It was obviously an irrational move,
right,
and one in passion. And it's like if you put yourself on, if you stand on a ledge, right, and the wind comes and almost blows you off, is it the wind's fault or is it your own fault for putting yourself in that position?
Well, I hear DA laughing there in the background. I like to push a little bit on that one. Because, you know, yes, if you stand on the edge of the ledge and the wind comes and blows you off, you know, you put yourself in harm's way on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, the wind is kind of not capable of rational thought. And true enough, it sounds like the man driving the car was very angry for some reason. But, you know, aren't we still responsible for our acts, even if we're provoked?
Yes, we are responsible for our acts, but I think what I'm trying to say is the wind analogy was probably not the best one, because you're right, that's a force as opposed to an individual who has a mind. But I think that, you know, when I read that a woman jumped on a man's car, I kind of thought, well, she's a little bit nuts. Mm-hmm. When I read that he drove off and kept going like that fast and for that far, then I thought he's nuts. And I think we have a case of two people whose tempers got the best of them. Mm-hmm. And I just don't like the fact that every time it's a, if it were two women, what would we be saying?
Mm.
If it were two men, what would we be saying? I don't like a lot of times when there's confrontation between a man and a woman for us to automatically be, you know, sympathetic to the woman and really make a lot of excuses for bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And not be fair.
Well, you know, I was trying to make this not about gender, but at the same time, it kind of is, you know, howling as an issue. You know, a lot of domestic cases are gendered in that way. So you brought up something that's very interesting. Dee, I heard that you were about to make a comment about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I tend to, I think Alicia has a valid point. In the fact that when one of the things that I do when I talk to individuals who are in conflict, one of my mantras is, it is irrational to try to be rational with an irrational person.
Okay.
And if, again, if she was on the car prior to him pulling off, which means that was her method of trying to secure him to the premises with, you know, trying to make him or compel him not to leave. And from what I understand, this is a married couple.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like that they are just, you know, people who just started dating or something like that. And so I agree with Alicia that they both were acting irrational in the beginning, and is the reason why this escalated to this point is because we don't teach people skills of de-escalation.
Okay.
And if we teach people skills of de-escalation, I believe this would be a non-story. But because most times when we react in during a conflict, it is out of basic human needs, right? We feel like something has been taken away from us, and I've, you know, coined that as the five basic human needs. It's a play off of Maslow's hierarchy, but it's still it's what I say. When people feel that these basic human needs are taken away, they react in a very negative and irrational way most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And those five are, when I feel like that I've been disrespected, so respect is one.
Right.
Autonomy is another. Fairness is another. Security is number four, and number five is a sense of belonging, right? So we've got respect, autonomy, fairness, security, and a sense of belonging. Those five are driven by our primary or secondary, and sometimes even tertiary emotions, okay?
Okay.
So if you see a volcano, right, you see what's coming out, right? So you see the rage, you see the anger, you see the violence, You see the frustration, right? This is what you see. But what most of us don't see is what's underneath that volcano, right?
Mm-hmm.
The lava that's pushing that flow out. And so your emotions are a part of that process. So if I can tap into what's the trigger for me, right? These are what
mm-hmm.
we call anger triggers. So I have to tap into what the emotion. So, for example, one of my, so if you go to a pet peeve, right, if you're a pet peeve of mine is being stuck in traffic late for a meeting, right?
Yes.
I react in an angry way. Right?
I think you're kind of in good company with that.
Yeah, right? So I have to ask myself, what is the primary emotions that I'm feeling at that time? Right, when I'm stuck in traffic and I can't, you know, and I'm late for a meeting with my boss or with a very important client or something like that. So I'm feeling helpless, right? I have to go to my feelings. I feel helpless. And maybe a secondary emotion is I feel incompetent, whether it's true or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then I have to go back to, so what is the basic human need I'm missing based on my primary emotions, right? So if I go back to that, then of the five basic human needs, my autonomy has been taken away from me,
right?
So if I can tap into, okay, it's been taken away, now let's create or reframe this in a way to give us a new perspective on this issue so I can de-escalate myself, right, to be able to think and handle the situation in a calm and professional and competent manner. So I say, you know, there is nothing I can do about the traffic. I can't get out and move the cars. So I accept, right, the fact of my fate and then do what I need to do, which is call into the office to say, I am stuck in traffic, you know, my apologies, could we reschedule for another time, right? And then, you know, put on some jazz music and just, you know, enjoy the ride.
So it sounds like accepting that you cannot change the situation. It sounds like you're talking about the prayer of St. Francis, isn't it, right? God grant me the serenity, right?
Yeah, the serenity prayer, right?
Exactly.
There are some things you can't change, and there are things you can, and you need to know the difference between the two. Yeah.
Right. So in this situation with this couple, because what you're talking about is really useful, I think, for people who are listening, who find mm-hmm. themselves really empathizing with the gentleman driving the car. You know, apparently he was pushed to some kind of brink. He tried to get away.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, you know, she stays in front of him. So there's this issue of autonomy, right?
Right.
And respect, I suppose,
right.
You know, for his autonomy. So she didn't respect his wish to leave. And
mm-hmm.
She tried to control him by making
right.
him stay. So
mm-hmm.
those two human needs had been threatened. So
right.
You know, what would you have said in this situation? How would you work with a couple who is experiencing this kind of thing?
So one of the things that I would have, one of the things I always try to get couples to realize that it's okay to say what you're feeling, okay? To say what you're experiencing, to say how you're experiencing it. And that's what we try to teach people, to be assertive.
Okay.
And when you're being assertive, you talk from the perspective of feelings, concerns, and needs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I take into account the other person's feelings, concerns, and needs,
mm-hmm.
okay? So if I was this gentleman, and I've been in this situation in past relationship. I never made it to the car. But the person stood at the door and took my keys.
Oh.
Right? So they stood in the door, stood at the lock, right? So shut the door, stood in front of it, and took my keys and held them, right?
Right.
Now, if I was irrational, I would have tried to struggle with that individual to fight them to get my keys back, right? Because I have to think about, I'm being held against my will. What is the basic human need being taken away from me? My autonomy, right?
Okay.
And so if that's important to me, so I need to be able to say to myself and need to be able to say out loud, right? So let's say, we'll say her name is Jane. You know, Jane, I feel really distressed and upset right now. And I'm concerned that if I cannot leave, right, things will escalate and get worse.
Okay.
So I need you to allow me to leave with the expectation that I will return once I feel that I've had the opportunity to process and we can have a conversation at a lower de-escalated, well, you won't use the word de-escalated.
Sure.
At a lower level, right? At a calmer state.
Right.
Because if I stay right now, it will not, I don't believe it will continue to go well.
So you've done it right there in that conversation. You named the feeling, you named the concern, and you named the need.
Right.
Okay.
The other part of that is making sure that you keep valid facts, right? So you want to make sure that you're using valid information. A lot of times when people get in conversations like this or discussions or I always say debates, they tend to be passive-aggressive or passive or even sometimes, right, aggressive. We see here that this young lady totally went aggressive by jumping on the hood. And her husband responded in an aggressive way by just continuing to ignore her and to keep driving, right?
Right.
So there's a difference between assertive behavior and passive-aggressive, and obviously aggressive behavior. And I think that the husband, you know, once he sees the wife on the car, right, he steps out of the vehicle and asks her, you know, to remove herself from the vehicle, you know, and try to, again, de-escalate the situation to where they can make a rational decision about what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what you've said answers, in a sense, a question that somebody in the chat room asked, or actually a comment that somebody in the chat room made a few minutes ago. And the person in the chat room said maybe she felt disrespected by him walking out on what she considered unresolved business. And so, you know, that is what fueled her action, why she ended up standing up in front of the car. But you described a conversation that he could have had with her, something he could have said to her, where he described how he was feeling, what his concerns were, and what his needs were, and perhaps that would have addressed her feeling of disrespect, of being, actually, she wouldn't have then felt disrespected by him walking out. What are you thinking about that?
Absolutely. I totally agree with that, right? Again, I am, again, by me telling you how I'm feeling, what I need, and what my concerns are, but at the same time, I am also thinking about your feelings, concerns, and needs by trying to have you understand, not that you agree, right, but just trying to have you understand the perspective from which I'm coming from right now. I tell people all the time, not all conflict can be resolved. What we have to learn to do is to manage the conflict. The management of conflict is the growing edge of a healthy relationship, I'm going to say that one more time.
Okay.
The management, right, of the conflict, not the resolution, but the management of the conflict is the growing edge of a healthy relationship.
Deep.
If we can say we're willing to put in the work to manage this conflict, because think about it this way. So let's say you and I are dating, and you come to me and you say, "DA, we need to talk." Okay, that's a dreaded sentence that people don't want to hear.
Right.
The
stereotype is that it's the men who don't want to hear it. Man hears that sentence and he is running. It's like, in the cartoon where the legs going, they're turning, and he's going to run off, right?
So that's why I say, I try to put it in a perspective to where, sometimes, yes. So, yeah, it is normally, usually, right, the men who hear that. And so once I hear that, right, we start at a baseline of calm. And then what happens once I hear those words, my anxiety level goes up, right? I become anxious. So what happens physically to me when I become anxious, right? So you have to go back a couple of 100,000 years to the Neanderthal phase, to what we call the amygdala, that mm-hmm. reptilian part of your brain that you still have. And the amygdala is there to let you know when a threat is upon you, okay? And even today, right, like I said, today we still have our amygdala, that reptilian part of our brain. And today psychologists call it what? Fight or flight.
Okay.
So you have a classic example of it even with this story of this young lady and her husband.
Right.
In the fight or flight, right, so what happens is, blood flows away from our smaller extremities to our larger extremities. So we can either stand and defend ourselves or, run away to live to fight another day. And again, we still have these as a part of our conflict style today. And so once my anxiety gets up and I'm continuing to have this conversation and it is not going where I want it to go, well, guess what happens from there? So we escalate to agitation, right?
Okay.
Now, Batabile, what normally happens when you're agitated?
Well, when you're agitated, physical manifestation, your eyes might be darting around or start kind of bouncing up and down. Your heart rate might go up.
Right.
You're not able to think straight.
Right. You start exhibiting signs of your anxiety, right?
Okay.
And so it's hard for me to talk. Now, again, notice what happens with the blood, right? The more blood that goes to your brain, what can you do better?
Well, you can think
better.
Yeah.
Right. But if I'm in threat mode, the blood has left my brain.
Okay.
For the most part, right? Because I need it somewhere else. And I can't think straight. So I have to make a conscious effort. I have to make a conscious effort to think rationally and logically. And I have to say to myself, Dee, what's really being taken away from you here? If anything, right, and to be able to put it all in perspective.
Okay. I have a question.
Yeah.
I'm going to jump in here and ask a question because you described a situation where a person has the wherewithal in that moment to have a feelings, concerns, and needs conversation.
Okay.
Now, come on now, really. What is the likelihood that under the circumstances that led to this trip down the highway,
mm-hmm.
anybody involved is going to be able to step back and have and feelings, concerns, and needs conversation. I mean, how do you expect people to be able to do that?
Well, my expectation is that we, you know, people like you and I, are out there teaching people how to do this.
Okay.
Right. So when you have unskilled people, yes, it's going to end up in the paper like this or worse, right? But if just one of those persons were skilled, right, this situation would have been totally different.
Okay.
If they had just had a small smidgen of what it means to be assertive, and again, that's me thinking about not just myself, but the other person as well.
So if they had listened to my show,
absolutely, right? If they had listened to one of your previous shows, right?
Right, exactly. Shameless
part
plug.
Part one and part two.
Right. Shameless plug.
Right?
But yes, you're right.
And make sure you go back and listen to the podcast of those. I went back and listened myself, and I learned a lot, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you. From a colleague, that means a lot.
So what's important, Batavla, is that we have to make a more concerted effort, I believe, in this country and even in other countries, but I can only speak for this because I'm here,
mm-hmm.
To the same way we educate people about smoking, same way we educate people about litter, same way we educate people about breast cancer, we need to do the same thing for domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to be on that scale where we try to educate the public, the population, to give them skills. You know, back in the day when I was growing up,
way back in the day, right?
There used to be these commercials on television about child abuse.
Hmm.
And, you know, this kid was crying. He wouldn't shut up. He wouldn't stop crying. And the mom was just overwhelmed and frustrated, and she raised her hand to hit the kid.
Hmm.
And the voice in the background says, stop, count to 10,
mm-hmm.
right? And so this woman counts down to 10, and by the time she gets to 10, she's in a different frame of mind about how she wants to handle this crying child. So it's that kind of public, right, public service announcements, those public service education programs that I think people like you, like I, like the, you know, national mediators, DV people, ombudsmen, right, we need to be pushing the government to say we need to be educating the community around ways to handle and resolve issues of conflict that are arising.
Wow. Yes. You know, you're helping me actually personally as I am thinking about the direction of this show. And that precisely is the reason that I started the show, is so that there can be a public conversation about these issues, and then also a way for us as a community to come together, talk about these issues, and learn skills, because you're talking about skills, and that these skills take practice.
Right. Absolutely. We started a place what we call unconscious incompetence. It's what I don't know, I don't know. And then the hope is, with some education and awareness, we move to conscious incompetence. It's where I know what I don't know.
Right.
Then to that we continue to practice and we continue to, the awareness campaigns to where we move to conscious competence. Right,
mm-hmm.
I know what my deficiencies are, and I'm practicing it on a regular basis in order, and I'm having to make an effort, right, to be better at what it is I'm deficient at. So ultimately, we move to unconscious competence. I don't even think about it. It's just a part of me, of who I am, right? So if I asked you to tell me your ABCs, you could do it without even thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Because it's called unconscious competence. You know certain numbers, you know certain figures, and that's because of the fact of your awareness, the over and over again repetition that you participated in that process, and then eventually it just becomes a part of who you are.
So in the situation
ahead.
Of this story, then, it is not unreasonable to think that a person can reach a level of unconscious competence so that even if they're so angry that in another situation they might, you know, go driving down the highway
mm-hmm.
with a person hanging on the hood, they can pull themselves back from that without even thinking about it and engage in that feelings, concerns, needs conversation, again, without
mm-hmm.
thinking about it. It's kind of natural.
Right. They wouldn't even, as a matter of fact, there was no way that they would even get in the car, okay? The
mm-hmm.
moment you jump on my hood, I know to start walking or to try and diffuse and de-escalate the situation by listening to you, right? To actively listen to you, to paraphrase, to ask you questions, slow down the conversation. And I guarantee you, this wife felt right. I think whoever wrote that in the chat room was right. She felt that she was disrespected because her husband was not doing what? Listening to her.
Well, and we know that that's not an unusual concern in relationships, right? He never listens to me. How many times do women, you know, you hear, especially women, I didn't want this to be about gender, but it keeps coming up.
You keep bringing it up, so I'm going to let you do it.
He never listens to me. Right.
Hey,
and,
folks,
uh-huh.
folks, when you write your nasty letters, write them to Batavele.
Oh, no. And I will forward them right on to you. We talked about shared responsibility, right?
Yeah, there you go.
I have a caller on the line in the 909 area code, and I hope that this person actually does intend to be on the line, but I'm going to go to you, 909, and go ahead and ask your question. Caller, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for listening to the show and for calling in. What is your question or your comment?
Well, I had a comment, and, I guess I just have two comments. But I wanted to say, first of all, I really liked what your first caller said. I thought that was a really balanced way of looking at that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to say about your guest, your guest had said, one thing that I wanted to bring about what your guest had said was, you know, when a man and a woman are having an argument, the man thinks that the way to make things get better is to leave so that people can calm down. But the woman feels like if he leaves, things are only going to get worse. And that's why she'll try and make him stay so that they can solve the problem, and it just doesn't get any worse than that. And I liked what your guest said about that rational conversation. I think he's absolutely right, and it is definitely something that everyone can learn to do, because that's how you keep from killing your children, is you have to learn those type of things, you know, and whatever it is that keeps you from putting your hands on them, whether you look at them and you're like, well, I don't want to go to jail today, you know, there's something that that helps you, but you can practice those things and you can learn it.
Yeah.
So I really like the way you guys are, teaching that and encouraging it, because it is definitely something that everyone can do. But I wanted to disagree with your first caller. Well, no, not disagree with her, because, you know, she didn't necessarily say he wasn't trying to kill her. But the reason why I think that he was definitely trying to kill her was because of the speeds that he was driving. You see, I think that had he left there and she wasn't on the hood of his car, I doubt that he would have been driving 100 miles an hour. And if he was just trying to get away, he would have just driven like 35 miles an hour with her on the hood, driving her to the police department or driving wherever he was trying to get to. You know, I mean, just imagining how fast is 100 miles an hour when you're in the car. Imagine that you're driving in the car, you've got your foot down, and you're looking out the windshield, and his wife is right there in his face. He was probably screaming his head off, going, "Die!" You know, I don't know what he was saying, but, I mean, to drive that fast, there is nothing else that he could have imagined was going to happen, that she was going to die. And I think that the only reason why he slowed down was because he probably decided that it doesn't matter how fast he drives, he's not going to shake her. And that's the only reason why he slowed down. But he was definitely trying to kill her. And, you know, unless he can show a history of, you know, like that he was off his meds or something, I completely support him being charged with murder. Absolutely. It doesn't matter how much someone provokes you, that doesn't give you the right to try and kill them, basically.
Well, thank you for your comments. And, you know, you've brought in a perspective that stands sort of, well, you know, parallel to what other folks are saying. You haven't said that she wasn't at all responsible in terms of, you know, being involved in the fight. And you brought up something that's really key in terms of some differences, stereotypical differences, I guess, but you know, differences in how men and women might view the best way to deal with an argument, especially if they are not trained, if they don't have that unconscious competence. It's like a tongue twister. Unconscious competence that we've been talking about, DA, where, you know, they haven't been listening to my show or reading the books or attending seminars and workshops or going to their ombudsperson at work. You know, one of the reasons that I thought it would be great to bring you on the show as well is to get that name out there so that folks can go into work tomorrow and look on their rosters and see, do I have an ombudsman in my corporation or, you know, at my institution, my school? A lot of government institutions and a lot of corporations and academic institutions now have ombudsmen, and that is a valuable resource that one can look out for. It's free. You know, they're hired by your company, and they're available to you and confidential. That's something that's really important to understand. DA, what do you tell people are the consequences of coming to see you in your office?
There are no consequences of coming to see me in my office. If the conversation remains confidential. I always tell people it's not my job to get you in trouble. It's my job to try to help you think out your options, regardless of, you know, what you may have or have not done. I know a lot of situations there are some, you know, there are a few things that we cannot keep confidential, and that's if you're going to harm someone else, mm-hmm. or if you're going to harm yourself, or if you've committed a crime or going to commit a crime. And so, you know, under those circumstances, I can't keep that information confidential, but everything else. Mm-hmm. And trust me, I've heard it all. You know, I tell people a lot of times what I try to create in my office is a sanctuary where people can come and talk about issues without judgment, condemnation. I'm just an objective sounding board sometimes, mm-hmm. and people don't want something done. Sometimes people feel that they're being discriminated against or harassed, or they're in a bad relationship with their managers. I've never come across so many bad marriages at work, and I use the term marriage very loosely, mm-hmm. between employers and employees, right? There's so many divorces. There are people in bad marriages who want to divorce, but because of the economy, they can't leave. One of the things that we found, we did some research there at the university, and we found that most people don't leave their jobs. They leave their managers.
Huh.
they love what they do. They love their work. They just don't want to do it for the person who's managing them. And we lose a lot of good people at organizations because people are in bad marriages at work. So unfortunately, we're seeing a rash of that now. And when the economy turns around, I think a lot of employers are going to be in for an awakening, you know, as employees begin to migrate to other places.
Right. So suddenly when the economy opens up and other jobs are available, you might see, you know, at least a blip of some kind of people leaving their work. It's sort of an exodus of people who otherwise were stuck because they were unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's funny, when I was working as an ombuds as well, I'd be conflict coaching with two people, and often it was coworkers, and we'd get somewhere midway through the conversation and somebody would pipe up and say, "Wait a minute, this feels like couples therapy."
I get that all the time.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's this sort of shocked look of surprise, and I said, "Well, you know, you are in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is a dyadic relationship. It's a two-person relationship that is, you know, vulnerable to all of the pressures of any two-person relationship."
Right, right. And it's important for people to understand that there are dynamics that that go with that. If you think of the amount of time that you spend at work with this individual, you spend more waking hours, for the most part, you spend more waking hours with your coworkers than you do at home.
Right.
With your family. You know?
Right.
And that's significant. That's very significant. And if we can't figure out how to navigate those relationships, you see what happens when people walk into your organization and they either, you know, shoot people or they, you know, do something to sabotage the organization in some way because they feel like that they were not heard. You know, I still go back to that young lady in California. I guarantee the reason why she jumped on that car was to get her husband's attention. She never imagined that this man would drive 35 miles at 100
miles an hour
sometimes.
Or 1 mile,
right?
Or 1 mile,
on the hood.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. As a matter of fact, how she ended up on the hood seems to be a bit of a question. And I don't know that there were actually any witnesses to her precisely getting on the hood. But, you know, it sounds as though she might have just sort of stood in front of the car and he took off. And, you know, she, instead of jumping to the side, what do you do in a minute like that, especially when you're surprised? You really don't think that this person's going to do that kind of thing. So she ended up on the hood of the car.
Well, you know, I can imagine it in my mind's eye. I can see, because this was a minivan.
Yes.
I could see her standing in front of the vehicle, you know, like the guy at Tiananmen Square in front of the tank, daring the soldier to run over him. And I think her husband started moving forward in the vehicle, and she jumped on the hood.
Right.
That's just my imagination. That's
right.
That's how I can, you know, envision that happening. And he was so enraged by that he's like, "Fine, if you're going to be on the hood, I'm going anyway." Right?
Well, you know, I've been debating back and forth as to whether to bring this up, but I really sympathize and sympathize with that situation, because that is something that actually happened in high school. With a friend of mine.
You have a real life experience?
Yeah.
Wow.
We had a fight. He jumped in his car and I jumped on the hood. And he put the car in reverse and I slid off the hood.
So the husband went the wrong way. He should have gone backwards.
He should have put the car in reverse. So, you know, very intelligent people, because, you know, I think that I'm an intelligent person, and I know he's an intelligent person. I don't know if he's listening and if he remembers this, what happened. He, of course, was horribly sorry, and he stopped the car immediately and got out to see if I was all right. And thankfully, I have a lot of hair. So, you know, I did slide off the car, and we never talked about it. It has remained a deep, dark secret until now. Now the whole world knows that this happened. But I certainly can understand. Now, you know, being who I am now with the training that I have now, I would hope that this situation would have resolved itself in a much different way. But I certainly can't understand how otherwise intelligent, rational people can reach that point where, as you said, the amygdala kicks in and it's fight or flight.
Right.
And as the caller said, you know, women and men often have different reactions to things. His reaction is, it's better for me to leave. This thing is getting out of control. And her reaction is, if he leaves, it's going to get worse.
Sure.
And so, yeah, go ahead.
You know, I'm sorry, but I have to bring this up because, again, I have to go back to that relationship I was telling you about earlier. So one of the ways, and the caller brought this to my mind when she talked about the differences sometimes that men and women have in relationships. So my then wife would, her way of punishing me was to leave the house, right? To rob me of her presence. Okay. But I didn't see it as a punishment, right? It's not a punishment to me.
Okay.
I saw it as, you know, oh, thank God, I'll get some peace, right? It's an opportunity to allow cooler heads to prevail. And so eventually she got to the point where she would pick up her keys, walk out of the house, and then I could count down to the time she was going to walk back in the door.
Well, was she expecting you to chase her?
No, I think it was just the act of, I'm going to leave, and, you know, you better be here when I get back, right?
Okay.
I'm going to rob you of my presence, and your punishment is you will have to stay here without me. But for me, I just get in my car and leave too.
Okay.
I would leave, and when she comes back home, I'm not there.
Okay.
Again.
Okay.
It's passive-aggressive behavior, right? So once I learned better, you know, I was able to say, sweetheart, when you leave, it makes me feel as if what we're talking about is not important to you and that you're running away from our discussion.
Okay.
I'm concerned that if you keep doing that, we will not be able to resolve whatever issue it is that is causing us to continue to have this debate. What I need from you is, even when you're feeling uncomfortable, right? Because for me, there's a difference between uncomfortable and unsafe.
Right.
Okay? So I'm saying, even when you feel uncomfortable, I need you to hang in there with me and let's try to talk this out.
So feelings, concerns, and needs, again, very important.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Listen,
you can tap into that. I think you'll be good.
Right, right. We've got another caller here, again, from the 909 area code, but a different number. And I'm going to bring them on, and I hope that you've intended to be on the air. Okay, so caller in the 909 area code, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
You're very welcome, and I'm glad that you're listening.
You know, the guest for today had made a comment earlier in the show that, you know, in his practice, he has become surprised at how people are willing to talk openly about harming another person.
Uh-huh.
And that really struck a chord with me as I just, you know, you can just follow Facebook, you know, and see the comments the young people are making, and how the lyrics from the musicians of the day, especially in more urban circles feeds almost directly into the vernacular. There's, for instance, an artist out now who has a song that talks about defecating on her enemies, I guess. And this becomes part of the talk of the young people of this group. How do we begin to change the tone of society or stop a culture of violence when it seems that the young people are being fed this from an early age without without people to kind of step in and tell a different story or say, hey, this isn't appropriate.
You know, Vitaly, I think the caller, what's your name, sir?
I'm Jonathan.
Hey, Jonathan. I think you're actually hitting on a very salient theme that a lot of I know educators and persons in the world of domestic violence and violence in general, right? Well, at least violence prevention, are now trying to find out, but whether or not, like I said earlier, we've become so desensitized to violence that it is a part of our unconscious competence now, right?
Mm-hmm.
We talk about it in a way where it's a part of our daily life, and it's nothing unusual for us to hear about body counts or people being murdered or people being shot, or because it's been happening so long. I know I'm a part of Generation X, and I know that we have, gangster rap and rap in general back in the day was, that was one of the knocks on the music was it's so violent. With NWA, Ice-T, Ice Cube, all these guys. And so, I mean, my question to you is, has it changed? I don't see generationally how the lyrics are any different from when I was a boy to now that, when you've got F the police and all these other things, what's different from what you're hearing today?
That's a good point. We could probably look further and further back and find that it's really been, just a part of society for as long as societies have been in existence. But my special, concern is for those members of society who don't have the framework in place to make sure that they, don't follow a pathway of violence and a path that, essentially emulates the message that they're receiving. Because I have a feeling that I know for myself, I had that in place and, I was able to avoid those pitfalls. I imagine you could say that, something pretty similar. But for many people, that doesn't seem to be the case. Is this something that we accept as that's just how it is, and these things will always happen, or is there a real play to be made in order to actually affect noticeable and significant change?
I think you're on to what a lot of parents are asking. That same question, what can we do to change the culture, the norms, and the values of our children today? Because 20 years from now, they're going to be in our shoes. And I, for me, that unconscious competence piece around violence will just be so a part of who they are that it'll, I think it will just be an afterthought. Unless, like you said, we need some sort of educational campaign to try and sway the minds of the generation to come. So, no, you've hit on something that's a very tough answer to give.
Well, you know, and you, DA, are bringing up something that is of deep concern because you're talking about what becomes our unconscious competence. And if violence is the unconscious competence, you know, then we're really in trouble. Caller, thank you so much for your comments and your discussion. We're going to move on to another caller in just a moment. Yes, you know, I'm reminded, DA, of an experience I had on the train, on the subway here in the city a couple of months ago where a woman bumped me. Now, you know, you get bumped around on the train all the time, but this one, I think she hit me in the head, actually, and you know, didn't look around and didn't apologize or anything like that. And I think, you know, as a reflex action, I rolled my eyes and sort of made a noise, right? And there was a gentleman who was standing next to me, and he immediately turned to me and put his hands up and said, "Don't, it's okay, you know, chill." And I thought to myself, wow, where is he coming from where he seems to assume that I'm going to turn around and either cut this woman off out or haul off and there's going to be a fight? Because that's what I could sort of see in his eyes and his reaction, that he felt that he needed to step in and stop that kind of thing from happening. He's seen what happened and how hard she hit me. And I think that rationally in his mind, he thought that the, you know, what he would expect as a reaction would be for me to turn around and give her back the same that I got.
Right. So the best thing to do then is to ask the question, what did he see in your nonverbal cues that would make him think that you would react? Or based on his experience of the past, right, his conscious competence, right, he wanted to be able to step in to prevent you from reacting a way that maybe he saw others have reacted in the past. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So that may be his impetus for trying to cut into your emotionalism and get you to be rational. Right?
Right.
And
you know, I was really surprised because, you know, being involved in physical violence or even verbal violence was the last thing on my mind. You know, I sort of had this reaction where I got hit on the head, it hurt. And so I reacted to that. But, you know, my thought is, look, I want to get to work or to wherever it was I was going. I'm not dead. So, you know, it's fine. It's going to be okay. But it really did, you know, surprise me. It was a different experience for me to have somebody have that reaction and an expectation that I was going to react in a way that he would feel it wise to step in. I'm going to go ahead and go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
No,
I was going
to bring in
a call. That's a part of that. That's a part of, for me, the conscious piece, the conscious competence, I'm sorry. You know, he wants to make sure that he does, he's seen, obviously, or experienced something in a negative way, or more than once. And so he wanted to be able to, you know, step in and try to do what he could to stop that. So, yeah, good for him.
So, yes, we have a caller in the 917 area code, and I believe it's a different number from the number I saw before, so I think that you actually are intending to be on the air, but we're going to find out. 917 area code, hello, you're on the air.
Hey, Bath, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine. This is Ian out here in Brooklyn. How you doing?
Ian, it's good to hear you. Say hi to Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Shout out to Brooklyn.
Hey, Brooklyn. Yeah, in response, because, yeah, you know, I'm kind of in a rush right now, but in response to what you were saying about the incident on the train, I think what happened is because he's probably seen incidents like that go down in the past, you know, like mm-hmm. Like the guest said, he wanted to do intervention. He just wanted to nip it in the bud before it even started. You may not have intended to react a certain way, but based on prior experiences or maybe in, from his environment, and I don't know what the race of person was, but he's like, okay, look, one sister, you don't need this right now. This is how I would react, you know, to you. I said, sister, look, right now I know you're trying to get to work. This is just going to lead to problems. We're just going to look bad on this train. Come on, this is how I would handle the situation. Just leave it alone. Let's go. Mm-hmm. Come on, let's go. You know, he wants to calm you down before you even get to that point.
Exactly.
Yep.
No, you're absolutely right.
You know, and because, you know, we already have enough YouTube videos out there with us acting wild and doing all these kind of things on the train. You know, you just don't want to see another sister go down. But I want to go back to one of the earlier points. I forget the guy from the 909, he was saying something about the culture and the music, how it's affecting the youth. Okay, it's only because the violence is commercialized now, because the violence in media has always been there. I mean, if you want to really go back further than the 80s, before the whole NWA, before this whole West Coast, East Coast, Ice Club, Ice Cube, Ice T, Colors, whatever, blaxploitation was doing the same exact thing on film.
Mm.
Okay. Mm. This is the generation that this generation grew up idolizing. But see, they weren't mm-hmm. at a stage where they could actually act it out. But see, now they're in a position, because a lot of them do have money, a lot of them do have positions, and a lot of these executives are allowing this music to go through. This is why this kind of music is going out. And, you know, and metaphorically speaking, a lot of it is just wordplay, because even if you go back to the Jamaican dancehall scene, a lot of the lyrics on face value seem violent. But when you take the words and understand they're just replacing one word with another, it's only, I think it's what's basically what it's called. It's called battle rap. So they're trying to make everything sound confrontational, but then when you really, you know, understand the true meaning of what they're saying, you realize it's not really they're talking violent, but they're trying to, I don't know, they're trying to out, you know, they're trying to use wordplay on each other. And, you know, the more tricky it sounds, you know, the more it comes across as like, oh, wow, that was really slick, you know?
So it's kind of like playing the dozens, you know, your mother's so whatever.
Right, it's kind of like, it's just playing the dozens in the music. Basically, that's what it is.
Okay. Mm.
You know, and, but, you know, as far as like the violence on the street, this has always been it. I mean, even if you go back, let's go back, you know, we can go back to movies like Scarface. You can go back to the 50s. I mean, the Italian community has been idolizing gangsterism for the longest. But we have, mm-hmm. you know, are we talking about their community? No. I mean, let's look at movies like the Gangs of New York. I mean,
mm-hmm.
this is violence that's been going on in New York City.
Right.
Way longer than we were actually accepted as people in the city. I mean, you know, that whole violent mentality has always been there. And we can even go back further. It's biblical.
Yes.
You know, if you really look in the Old Testament, I mean, really, God was like, wow, he was allowing these things. He was actually telling tribes and other people, go out and kill. So, you know, this is something that's embedded in us. I mean, if you can go back to Elizabethan times when they rewrote these books, I mean, come on. So this is not something that just happened. It's just that because the spotlight is on us, and we're the minority, but the majority ones being killed. So this is why it's emphasized, and the media just takes it and runs.
You said something that was really key when you were talking about going all the way back to Bible times. You know, my sister and I are looking to put together a radio show where we can tell children's stories from the Bible. And we thought it would be great to start with the story of Deborah and segue into the story of Yael, or Jael, I think is we call her in English, Yael, the woman who killed Sisera by driving a tank stake through his head. So we're thinking about how are we going to write the script for this, and we're telling this story to little kids. I'm like, can we do that? We can't tell this story. This woman takes a tent stake and takes a hammer and hammers it through the man's head.
Yeah.
So yes,
I mean,
violence.
Because,
go ahead.
If we want to know, the misogyny and all that. I mean, let's go back to what's saying who slept us with our father, got him drunk and slept him.
Right. Right. Yes. Lots of daughters.
You're right. Lots of daughters. Exactly.
Right.
Come on, So this is nothing new under the sun. It's just that, we're at a time now where it's a bigger world, and we're seeing it more and more and more, and it's not being covered up. So.
Right.
Ian,
you've
and
made
it's happened
a
all
point.
Over. You
can't, yeah.
You can't run from it. It's all over.
It is all over, and you've made a great point. There's somebody in the chat room who asked the question, does it seem like more of a problem because we have the media, because we have more access and faster access to more information? We're no longer as isolated in our communities where what makes news is what happens locally where you live, but we have instant access to news all over the world. And what tends to get reported is the bad stuff because that's what sells. Mm-hmm. That's what's
sure.
sensational. And so there is a concentration of negative stories or stories about violence, and that might be distorting the way that we actually view things. And that actually brings me into another part of the conversation, DA, that I wanted to get into. But I wanted to first thank Ian for calling in and for listening to the show and for the comments that you made. That was really important, what you brought up. That violence has always been with us, and maybe we are wringing our hands too much about what's going on in the present time. But, DA, one of the things that I had mentioned in the description of the show was, could we learn something from Japan? And, of course, we understand that Japan has suffered one of the greatest natural disasters.
Tragedies.
And tragedies, right, exactly. Tens of thousands of people are dead and missing. Whole villages have been utterly wiped, literally wiped away,
sure.
gone.
Yep.
There are pictures that you can see on the web where they show before and after in a very dramatic fashion what has happened with these communities being wiped away. And you're getting these stories out of Japan of tremendous kindness, tremendous sense of community, people stepping in and doing things for each other. And I'm wondering, some have wondered if that would happen in the United States, were we to experience a similar tragedy. What are you thinking about that?
As a person who lived in Japan for 3.5 years in the early 2000s, and I know the Japanese people because of my time I spent there, and from a person who did not want to get on the plane and come back to the United States of America.
Mm.
I literally cried when I heard that I had to leave Japan and come back to the United States. And my reasoning, I'm building up to something here.
Okay.
My reasoning for that was because of the people. The Japanese people were such loving and caring and customer focus, community focus, and made me feel not like a stranger, but not like one of them, but welcome. And so I really was not looking forward to coming back to the United States because of my history as a person of color here in the U.S.
Right.
But I know one thing about Americans is that we are very, very generous people. And in times of crisis, we band together. Regardless of how we feel about each other's ideologies or religion or race or gender, sexual orientation, I believe if something happened like that in the U.S., that we would, rise to the occasion and take care of each other. My hope is that the unfortunate piece is that the government has shown us that they don't have the capacity and that it's going to take regular, ordinary citizens to make this happen,
right.
to take care of one another. So, I believe that we would do the same as you have seen in Japan.
Well, you know, actually, we have an example of that. I was here in New York City on September 11th, 2001. And I was actually, I remember the day very clearly. It was one of the more gorgeous days from a weather perspective. The sky was just the most beautiful color of blue. And I remember thinking about that when I was on my way to class. And I was sitting in class when we got word that the first plane had hit the tower, and then by the time the second plane hit the second tower, we had gathered downstairs around a television there in the law school and, watched it happen live. And immediately people sought to, come into action and figure out what they could do. And I went to the hospital with a group of my friends to give blood. I'm O positive. And so, not a universal donor, but, being an O, I know that my blood is in high demand, and a bunch of us immediately dashed to the hospital and found ourselves having to wait in line to give blood. Of course, one of the tragedies of the situation is that it wasn't necessary. There were very few people who survived, who were pulled out from there, actually needing the blood. But the point of the matter is that it was our first thought was to band together and give. And there are a lot of stories about acts of heroism and kindness that came out from September 11th. And that says to me that, perhaps we judge ourselves harshly, you think?
Well, maybe, or, I think with the prior to tragedies, there was a lot of politicizing of issues and with no real substance. And people tend to like to have, we need a villain and a hero. And so prior to tragedies, I believe, and just my sense is that people tend to migrate toward the area of things that are of some level of affinity to themselves. And so, I know I was in Japan when 9/11 happened, and the outpouring of my Japanese friends, Malay friends, from all over the Far East, I got letters and phone calls from non-U.S. citizens who were horrified by what happened in this country. And so it was, it was almost 2 years before I came back to the United States because I was, deployed overseas. And so it was just, it was interesting that the U.S. had a different feel to it when I came back as well. So
what do you mean?
I totally agree.
But what do you mean that the U.S. had a different feel?
Well, when I left in 1999, we were, the economy was doing well. We had a president who was very popular but had some issues. We had a Congress that was impotent. And so it seemed to me that 9/11 had done something to the psyche of the United States. People were nicer. People were more attuned. And maybe it was because I was in the military that may have had something to do with it. But it was a sense that this level of customer service and being there for one another was more prevalent, if I can use that. So,
And I should explain for those who are listening that you were a chaplain
Yes, I was a Navy chaplain for 6 years, active duty. Served with the Marine Corps for most of my time, and got a chance to do my service, Iraqi freedom, as well as other places in the world. So, yeah.
So you've really experienced situations where, you know, being able to think rationally under intense stress is really important.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
One of my first experiences with that was in the Philippines, and I don't know if you remember, there were two American missionaries that were taken by the Abu Sayyaf.
I remember that.
And so my Marines, and we were a part of that contingency that went over to rescue them. So it was a very, untenable situation. Part of my job as a chaplain was to humanify my Marines to the community, to make them not just warriors but people. And so to go into a community that had been, you know, terrorized by a particular group of people, and to see how the final outcome of that situation, where one of the missionaries was shot, but he was shot protecting his wife. I've seen a lot of bad conflict and contentious situations where, you know, it's probably helped to hone my unconscious competence around these sort of issues.
Right. Talk about being tested in battle. That for you is a literal phrase. Quite literally.
Well, you know, one of the things my Marines, and I use this in real life, I try to, when I do conflict coaching, I talk to people about staying below the shot line. When you're out in a battlefield, there's a shot line, right? So you dig a hole, you dig your foxhole, the hole in the sand, or wherever it is that you're digging it. And there's a particular line you have to stay below, or else you're going to get picked off. If there's a sniper or, you know, enemy fire is coming in. And if you're going anywhere, my Marines would always say to me, Chappie, stay below the shot line. Don't get dead. So, and I try to, you know, let people know that at work, that sometimes people are gunning for you, and the best thing for you to do is to keep your head down and document what's happening to you, what's going on around you, and be able to eventually take that documentation and present it to someone who can do something about it.
Mm. Very important advice for folks. It's important in a different way when you're actually in battle and under enemy fire. But, for folks who are at work, perhaps feeling that they are under the gun, you're absolutely right. But one way to deal with a situation that can keep them from being in the line of fire is to keep their head down and, like you said, document what's going on and use the resources that the company makes available for dealing with situations like that. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right. You know, I'm going to take a little bit of a break here. We have about 20 minutes remaining in the show, but I want to take a break, give us a chance to give a breather, and then we're going to come back and summarize. And I have a couple of announcements that I'll need to make, and then we can summarize the show. So hang on with me for just a moment. We're going to be hearing a song from Somi. It's called Prayer to the Saint of the Brokenhearted. It comes from her 2009 release, If the Rains Come First. I'll talk to you in just a moment.
Our love and fire within, I sit with my heart and hand wide open. Knows then I couldn't remember till now, but it tastes just like yesterday. Come sit down and sleep over my bed, sweet pain of the broken hearted. Come down and sleep over my bed, sweet pain of the broken hearted. So I might be still, I might be, might be, I might be still. So I might be still, I might be, might be, I might be still. Feet on the ground, beautiful and burned. My heart seems fast, fatigue seems faster. Now the future couldn't dream of till now, but it tastes just like yesterday. Come down to me.
Welcome back to the show. This is Batabile Mtombeni coming to you live from Harlem, USA. You are listening to Untangled Resolutions presentation of The Problem is the Answer. And you've been listening to Somi. And the song that you just heard is called Prayer to the Saint of the Brokenhearted. It is an original. It is from her 2009 release called If the Rains Come First. And I want to let you know that Somi will be at New York City's legendary jazz club, the Jazz Standard, which is at 116th East 27th Street here in New York on March 29th and 30th. She and her band will record live selections from her last two albums, and both of which have received critical acclaim from various sources. She got a fantastic write-up in Vogue magazine, and also the Boston Globe said wonderful things about If the Rains Come First. And she has said that there will be guest appearances. The last song that I'm going to play at the end of the show is one on which Hugh Masekela is, and he is, of course, a legendary trumpet player who played with Mira Makeba. So I don't know. I'm going to have to ask her if one of the surprise special guests might include Hugh Masekela. Whatever the case is, be sure to go to the website for the Jazz Standard, and I'm going to try to figure out a way to get this information out to you either in blog form or on Facebook, where I'll give you information about Somi's website, which is www.somimusic.com, and Somi is spelled S-O-M-I, so it's S-O-M-I-music.com, and for tickets, you can go to the Jazz Standard's website. I also want to let you know that the Lady Got Chops Women's Month Music and Arts Festival is still going on. There are a number of shows left. I hope that you decide to go out. If you have missed the shows before, you can go to my music blog, www.artsypudding.blogspot.com. I've put together a video of snippets from various shows that I've been to. You don't want to miss what's left. Go to the festival's website, Kim Clark with an E. So that's Kim, C-L-A-R-K-E dot 8M.com /LadyFest9.html. And again, I'll try to make that information available to you so that you can see what dates are remaining and go out and support the festival and enjoy the music. Be sure to take some time out to go and do that. One more announcement. This month, I put out the finance issue of my e-zine, which is also called The Problem is the Answer. It is available on my website, www.123untangled.com. And while you're there, be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss an issue. Last week, I had financial expert and educator Dominic Reese on the show talking about smart ways to manage your money. She has a fantastic article in the e-zine about teaching your children good money management habits. Next week, we will return to the issue of your finances. So in the show next week, we're going to talk about money again, but from a different perspective. I'm going to invite Jesse Langle to be on the show. He is an attorney who specializes in suing credit card companies that harass their customers. So I am sure you're going to want to tune in to hear more about your rights as a consumer, especially if you or someone you know has creditors breathing down their neck. And in this economic time, who doesn't? So be sure to tune in next week and you can learn quite a bit. I heard him speak a couple of weeks ago and I learned a lot myself that I didn't know about the consumer protections that are out there to help people who find themselves in debt and have creditors knocking down the door. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Untangled Resolutions broadcast of The Problem is the Answer, a weekly radio show about communication and relationships. I am your host, Batavila Mtombeni, relationship coach and divorce mediator, coming to you live from Harlem, USA. Today, I have been talking with D.A. Graham, the Princeton University Ombudsman, and we are talking about the qualities of civility, empathy, and compassion in our communities. The title of the show is It Murder If She Asked For It? And it was inspired by an incident that happened in California where a woman jumped on the hood of the car that her husband drove away in when she tried to stop him from driving away, and he drove down the highway for 35 miles with her clinging to the car, and he went at speeds of up to 100 miles an hour and now has been charged with attempted murder and kidnapping. So the story itself was shocking and disconcerting, but I was as concerned by the reactions that I heard from people who asked the question, is it murder if she asked for it? And so that is what we have been talking about. And I'm going to bring DA back on the air now. And we've got about 5 or 6 minutes left for the show, and we're going to wrap up. DA, thank you so much. I want to go back to what you were telling us about developing an unconscious competence that allows us to have a feeling and concern and need conversation to de-escalate a situation, even when our amygdala is telling us, fight or fly.
Yes. I think one of the things that's important, Batavila, is that your audience members understand is that the way to help control a situation is to understand that what we have is a perception of incompatible aspirations.
Mm.
And what's significant there is the perception, because 9 times out of 10, that perception is wrong. I guarantee you this husband and wife, the Carrolls, they both wanted the same thing. If you actually, once you sat down with them separately and talked to them, if they could have just asked questions, right? In mediation and negotiation, we talk about positions, issues, and interests.
Yeah.
And so that has a lot to do with feelings, concerns, and needs. And
yeah.
So we have to be able to teach people to ask questions, get to the why, get to the issues. And one of the other techniques I try to teach people to use is what we call the six whys. I'm sure you've probably heard of that technique before. But the six whys helps you probe and get deeper into a situation to try to see and get to the root cause of the situation. Mm. And so basically what you would do is you have an issue, and then you ask the question, why? And then you ask it five more times after that. And by the what the concept is, by the time you get to the sixth why, you should have, if you're being honest, or if the other person is being honest with you, you should be at a level to where you've unearthed some unseen or unspoken of, or what we call hidden expectations, or you know, like I said, interest or issues that may be at the heart of the issue.
Right.
Or I'm sorry, the heart of the problem.
Right. Yeah. And you are right in terms of positions, interests, and needs. We've talked about that before on the show. That was called What is Your PIN? What is your position,
is
your interest,
part
and your needs?
Part one and part two.
Exactly. And then we also talked about separating intent from impact, and that's where we talk about getting down to the bottom of the issue, like you were talking about the six whys, getting to intent. And figuring out why people actually took the action they did or hold the position they do. These are very, very important concepts in conflict resolution.
Right. Well, one of the things I wanted to bring out, too, is that this issue of forgiveness. And I think it's important when you talk about compassion, when you talk about empathy, when you talk about trying to get to the heart of an issue, forgiveness is very important.
Yeah.
And being able to apologize is also key. Now, I have people in my office sometimes, and they'll say, I'm not sorry for what I said. I'm not sorry for what I did. And so if they're not willing to go there, I try to take them another route by asking, is it possible that you could apologize for the impact? Or for the perception, right? You still haven't apologized for what you did or what you said. You still feel strongly about that. But if you can apologize for the impact that it had or for the perception the other person walked away with, it gives you a tool now to begin a dialogue for resolving or managing the conflict.
Right.
So I try to encourage people to, if you can, or if you feel so led, as we would say in the church, to apologize for an impact of maybe something you said or did, or the perception of what you said or did. And it goes a long way with the other party. We found that out.
Right. Well, you know, I mediate at the CCRB, which is the Civilian Complaint Review Board here in New York City. And I must clarify for those who are listening out there, I don't work for the CCRB, and I don't work for the police. And generally speaking, people who come to the CCRB are people who have complaints regarding police action. And I can't tell you how amazing it is when somebody comes into that very charged atmosphere and apologizes.
Sure.
The power of apology cannot be overstated.
Mm-hmm.
And
amen.
So finding a place where you can actually acknowledge the harm that has been committed, even if you do feel that you were somehow justified in the action, acknowledging the harm can go a long way to reducing conflict and to managing conflict well.
Well, you know, one of the things that, since you brought that up, another place that happens, right, is hospitals.
Yes.
Doctors, right? Doctors are never wrong. And so one of the things we found is that when I was in the military and we had doctors who had made a mistake or something like that, we would always say, if you just apologize, it will lower the person's level of frustration and anger with you. But the lawyers would always come back with, no, we can apologize because that puts us in a position that makes us culpable, right? There's a level of admission that goes with an apology. And so that's when we came up with this concept of, okay, let's apologize for the impact then. Let's apologize for the perception if we can't apologize for what we've done. Let's apologize. Let's start with something, right? Mm-hmm. And so you're totally right. It does change the whole dynamics of a conflict situation when someone who had felt that they've been wronged hears a sincere apology from from the respondent. So, yeah, I totally agree with that.
Well, you know, DA, thank you so much. You have brought us very nicely to the close of our show by talking about how we can address harm, perhaps, in an interaction that we've had where perhaps we forgot or I forgot, somebody forgot about civility or empathy or compassion, that even if you have been involved in something that was harmful or hurtful, or you had a sort of knee-jerk reaction and that amygdala kicked in and you got involved in a fight-or-flight situation, you can come back and apologize, and it is a very powerful thing to do. So I thank you for bringing that up, and I thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate what you're trying to do with LA, and thanks for the invite.
You're very welcome. I hope I can invite you back someday.
Indeed. Anytime.
Awesome. Very nice. Thank you so much. And thank you all for listening today. We have had, I think, a substantive conversation. I invite you to share the word about the show with your friends and your family. You can listen to the show on demand through the website www.blogtalkradio.com/Batabile, and that's spelled B-A-T-H-A-B-I-L-E. And while you're there, please hit the follow button so that you will always be reminded of when the next show is coming up and what the next topic will be. I am looking forward to seeing you again next week. Have a wonderful week. Have a peaceful week. And I hope to talk with you soon. The song that you're going to hear is called Nganjani. It is, again, by Somi. And she is joined on this piece by the legendary Hugh Masekela. Enjoy and good evening.